And welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu, and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bors. So today, Jeremy Corbyn has written an op-ed for The Guardian setting out Labour's Brexit policy. Katie, he says that only Labour will give people a final say on Brexit. Tell us more.
So Jeremy Corbyn is appearing to unveil what he plans for the Brexit party policy to be in a forthcoming general election. There's a view there will be a general election before Christmas, and I think this is him trying to set out the stall. Now, before we get into what exactly it says, he has to get through Labour conference about his Brexit policy becoming altered. And we know in previous years, as in last year, there was an attempt by pro-EU Labour members to try and push him to a more Remain position. But what Jeremy Corbyn is saying he wants it to be is, if he is the Labour Prime Minister, he would renegotiate a Brexit deal, a softer Brexit deal, put things back in it, like workers' rights, put in a permanent customs union potentially. Then he would take that deal and he would put it to a vote in a second referendum, and there'd be two options, the deal or remaining. Mm. And he also says, we would then put that to a public vote alongside Remain. I will pledge to carry out whatever the people decide as a Labour Prime Minister. Now, this is being read quite widely as Jeremy Corbyn saying that in that referendum campaign, he wouldn't necessarily pick a side. Mm. I don't think it's completely clear, but it is interesting because we have seen an increasing number of members of the Labour shadow cabinet say that they would back Remain, they would go for Remain in the second referendum, and Jeremy Corbyn has chosen not to do that. So what does it mean generally? I think that it isn't so surprising in the sense that because we had the trade union congress last week where we saw unions back Jeremy Corbyn's plan for Brexit, there was a sense that he was trying to retain some Brexit ambiguity on the party's position. He's been under pressure from figures like Diane Abbott, from figures like Emily Thornberry to go further to the Remain end of the spectrum. So if you're going to have a second referendum to say that Labour's position would be Remain, he is resisting that. And I think it just comes back to, how does every party think an election will play out? Mm. Is it on this Remain leave axis? We've seen the Lib Dems go to be on a full-on party of revoke. We've seen the Tories go to pit themselves as the only party that really is there for leave, if you take Nigel Farage's Brexit party out of the equation. What Labour, I think, see is they don't quite buy that there is this Leave-Remain axis yet. They want to try and do an election where they can talk about domestic issues and thereby, they hope, keep lots of these leave seats in the Midlands and the North, which they think they would lose if they went full-on Remain. And I think on that, something I wrote about in The Spectator this week is the internal polling the party has been doing. And I think that Labour figures have been encouraged by the fact that when they have done focus groups in the Midlands and the North and areas where they have very tight marginal seats that they need to cling on to, let alone try and win more of, they found that Labour leave voters are still quite tribal. They still regard the Tories with suspicion, and they think what they deem as the Dennis Skinner voters, Dennis Skinner being a Eurosceptic who is tribally Labour, they think they can keep the bulk of them on side. So I think that is reflected in this position.
And we talk about that a little bit more in the latest episode of the Spectator podcast as well. James, just looking at that Labour deal a bit closer, he says that it's a credible leave offer, but really he wants to stay with the single market. He wants to stay in the customs, he wants to have a new customs union with the EU, sorry. Is that really going to please Leave voters who want to vote Labour?
I think this Labour position is great news for the Liberal Democrats. This is they have decided that they can stake out this middle ground on Brexit, that they basically can quarantine the issue and, as Katie says, fight the election on a classic left-right battleground. I think that is a real risk for them because I think people want clarity on Brexit now, and I think people want this over with one way or the other. And I think the problem with the Labour position is it doesn't offer either clarity or the promise of any swift resolution, because this is more negotiations with Brussels and then at least the 6 months it would take to have a referendum. So I think that is the problem.
But also a soft Brexit possibly.
I mean, I don't think it will be forcing market membership. I think it's a kind of, it's Labour's close relationship with the single market. I think they know that any leave option would, to be credible, would have to say it would end free movement. But I also think there's an interesting question here because there's no certainty in what Jeremy Corbyn is saying about which side of the referendum he would campaign on. There was an interesting report in the Times the other day from Brussels, with Brussels saying, you know, this is as mad, if not madder than anything the Tories have come up with, that they're going to come and negotiate a deal that they might then campaign against in a referendum. I think it is very complex. And I think it's an interesting sign of how, I mean, words we don't normally associate with Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn is trying to take the kind of moderate, compromise position on Brexit. But I think his problem is the country is becoming increasingly radicalised, and this could end up just massively falling between two stools. You know, in 2017, Jeremy Corbyn managed to ride two horses at once on Brexit with great success. I just think in 2019, that's just much, much harder. So much water has flowed under the bridge.
Especially with the Liberal Democrats and their comparatively more clear position
as well. There's a very good piece this morning in The Times from James Johnson, who was Theresa May's pollster. And he is making this point, which is if the Lib Dems do quite well at the next election, that's bad news for the Tories, because as Katie has written, there are a whole bunch of Lib Dem Tory marginals that would fall to the Lib Dems on a relatively small swing. But if the Lib Dems do very well, then that's good news for the Tories, because it basically means there are a whole bunch of Labour Tory marginals you wouldn't think of as places that the Tories could win in their current iteration, you know, Battersea, Canterbury, where the Tories might win even if their share of the vote goes down, because the Lib Dems have taken such a big chunk out of Labour vote with their clearer Remain position.
So James, does this open up Labour to vulnerability of criticism from other Remain parties as well? And I mean, Nicola Sturgeon today has jumped on Twitter calling it a shameful abdication of leadership.
I think you are going to see Labour being hammered from the rest of the so-called Remain alliance, basically saying, well, why can't you say which side it is? Because the SNP and the Lib Dems are in full-on revoke territory. Even the Greens, who are in favour of a second referendum, are very clear which side they would be campaigning on in that second referendum. So I think Labour will come under a lot of fire from the other Remain parties, because the other Remain parties, this offers them an opportunity.
And Katie, back home, is Boris Johnson getting any close to having his Brexit deal hammered down? We know that at Luxembourg things didn't go according to plan, but behind the scenes, is there movement?
So I think there is more hope at the start of the week than there is now what could be achieved at that lunch. I don't think there's a sense that it's moved backwards. It's just that had lunch been more successful, I think there'd be a sense that it was building up towards something. And instead, it's pretty much stayed where it is. You have, I think there is a sense among certain EU figures that what the Prime Minister of Luxembourg did with the embarrassing Boris Johnson, or at least trying to embarrass Boris Johnson at that press conference, was not a wise idea. And I don't think it was that reflective of the general mood in Brussels. But that said, it doesn't feel as though Boris Johnson has moved closer to agreeing to a substitute to the backstop, because Brussels are being so clear that they want these written firm proposals. The reason the UK side is reluctant to give this is because as soon as they put it in writing, everyone sees it.
Yeah.
They think that it's crucial to, I think, have certain things going before you get there. We know roughly what they are looking for in terms of this landing zone for a replacement to the backstop. So getting the DUP on side already to align on agricultural standards, having some things there. But I think one of the issues is checks on goods on the island of Ireland to avoid a hard border, and where this could take place, because on the UK side, they think they can take place on the island, but a bit away from the border. Mm-hmm. And I don't think as of yet it's clear that this is something Brussels is going to buy. I think there's also a sense that we're heading towards Tory conference and also to that EU Council summit meeting. So I think tactically, Boris Johnson might prefer to make his play once certain events are out of the way, such as Conservative Party conference.
James, how significant is Boris Johnson's ideal landing zone, this all-island agri-food zone? How significant is that for the unity of the United Kingdom? I mean, East-West checks in the Irish Sea, how stringent will they have to be for normal traders?
So I think East-West checks on agriculture, I don't think are a particular kind of particularly change anything about the constitutional settlement, because in extremis, they already exist. If we, for example, were to have foot and mouth in Great Britain, you couldn't take your cattle from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, because the island of Ireland is already treated as a single animal health zone, distinct from Great Britain. So I don't think that is a big deal. I think if these checks end up extending to manufactured goods,
not just agri-foods,
begins to become a different deal. But I also think it is worth noticing that devolution does mean that there's going to be difference between different parts of the UK. And there are already quite a few things that are different in Northern Ireland than they are in Great Britain. And I suspect that if you look at what is going on with devolution and the powers granted to the Scottish Parliament, you are going to see more variation within the UK. The UK is going to become more of a federal polity. And Northern Ireland could simply be the most extreme example of that. I think the crucial thing that is the movement of the DUP to this, moving away to this no-tariff border in the Irish Sea. Essentially, that is suggesting that if you can find some way to get round the problem of the old backstop that kept Northern Ireland in the customs union, you can begin to get some kind of movement, I think. So I think Casey's right. I don't think the chance of a deal increased at that lunch. They also didn't go backwards. And that means there probably is more chance than there was a week ago or so. But, you know, time is running short. And I think that this one of the other questions here is, I don't think you are going to see a deal done at 3 a.m. at the EU Council, simply because, I mean, these things are so legally complex. They're not the kind of thing that leaders... So you could get some impetus to a deal at the EU Council.
Mm.
But I don't think you're going to get a deal there. And then that means that Boris Johnson then runs into the red bill and this demand that he seeks an extension on October 19th.
So he'll have to seek an extension?
Well, I think he will do everything he can to avoid that. I just think you have to have... I think the level of technicality involved is such that I don't think this is going to be something that at 3 a.m.
yeah.
they can all work out what it is that they're going to do. I think you are going to need something...
Well, I suppose by that point, they can ask for a technical extension to fulfil the Ben Bill, but at the same time, the EU recognises that a deal is close.
I think the technical extension could only be to get the legislation through, if you see what I mean.
The deal has to be agreed beforehand.
The deal would have to be agreed. So I mean, I think time is running short. And in a way, I think the disappointment of lunch was that it could have catalysed the process. It could have pushed the deal forward. It hasn't really.
So, Katie, it's 5 years on from the last Scottish independence referendum. Do you think Nicola Sturgeon is any closer to a second Scottish referendum?
It's still hard to see exactly when it would be, but I do think that a Scottish independence referendum looks more likely than it did a couple of years ago.
Mm.
And that's partly because of various parties saying things. Like, if you get to that Scottish Parliament election in Holyrood, and there is a majority, a pro-independence majority, you've had Labour say that they would think that you should listen to that. And if the Scottish Parliament voted for a second independence referendum, Westminster should listen. So you can see a route there. You also had David Mundell, when I interviewed him in North Berwick over the summer, say that he could see the argument in that, which is that you have to listen to devolved institutions. So if there is a majority after that election for it, it's going to get harder for the politicians in Westminster to ignore it. I think part of the reason he was saying that potentially is because he still believes there is a pro-unionist majority in Scotland. And actually, by making the election ahead of the Scottish Parliament about the union, you prevent there being a majority for independence. Does that make sense? So because we don't know what the result of that Scottish Parliament election will be yet, I think there's still many hurdles to getting to an independence referendum. I think what's interesting, as we've seen today, Ruth Davidson, no longer a Scottish Conservative leader, basically pushing out and tweeting about a Scottish independence poll, which finds that a majority of Scots would vote to remain in the UK. Now, there's been other polls, as of everything, and there was one a few months ago people were very quick to seize on, which suggested independence was now ahead. But I think it does just show how close this type of referendum would be, and it would be impossible to predict. I think it would very much in the campaign, but the next couple of months, and I do think that Scottish Parliament election will be decisive.
James, Jo Swinson has a relatively good week, but one of the things that stumbled her this week was old videos that showed that she wanted a Brexit referendum, but now she's saying that even if the SNP get a majority at the next election in Scottish Parliament, she won't allow a second Scottish referendum. Do you think this sort of confusion over referendums is a problem for Jo Swinson? And I mean, if she was in some kind of government pact at the next Parliament, could she allow a second Scottish referendum?
So Jo Swinson has repeatedly said that she wouldn't put Jeremy Corbyn into Downing Street. I think one of the reasons she takes that position is not only that, you know, she doesn't agree with Jeremy Corbyn on a whole host of issues, and she knows he's electorally toxic to lots of the voters that the Lib Dems are trying to appeal to, but also it almost certainly, if Jeremy Corbyn was heading to Downing Street, it would be because he also had the SNP's support. And the highly likely that the condition for that support would be a second independence referendum. Jo Swinson is in a hyper-marginal seat where she has just won it back from the SNP. I don't think she would want a second independence referendum. And that's another reason why I think she has to say that she wouldn't put Jeremy Corbyn into Downing Street, because she can't look like she would, you know, she would undermine her own unionist voting base if she sounded like she was going to accept a second Scottish independence referendum. I think Katie's analysis, though, is right, which is if in 2021... explicit parties that explicitly want IndyRef 2 within the terms of that parliament win a majority, then I think it would be foolish for Westminster to say, no, you can't have it. I personally think it would be slightly pointless to have a second Scottish independence referendum until we know what the terms of the UK's exit from the EU are, because they have such massive implications for Scottish independence. For example, if the UK ends up leaving the EU without a deal, And the SNP's position was to read for an independent Scotland to join the European Union. That would mean that there would be a meaningful border between Scotland and our UK. But alternatively, you know, if the UK were to end up joining the EEA, for example, you could make a case that the border would be much less visible. So I think the nature of it is changed by that. I mean, I think my great worry about the union is that the 2014 independence referendum saw independence get so close that they will start the next campaign within touching distance of victory, whereas in 2014 they started way behind. And I think that, but I think there are developments in Scotland which I think do offer some encouragement to the union side. One, I think the domestic record of the SNP government is not that impressive. And given that the SNP are so inexplicably linked to the cause of independence, as dissatisfaction with the state of public services in Scotland, which are run by the Scottish government, increases, that I think will hurt the cause of independence. There are tensions and divisions in the SNP, and those are going to be massively exacerbated when Alex Salmond's trial starts.
Katie and James, thanks very much. And you can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, through all the usual routes. Do you remember to pick up your £20 Amazon voucher if you go on spectator.co.uk/voucher, and you'll also get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.